Okay, today we're going to continue with the molecular aspect of genetics. We've talked about transcription, the basic steps in transcription. Today we're going to talk about spend most of the time talking about RNA and gene structure and how the two relate. And today's one of those days where we will be contrasting prokaryotes and eukaryotes quite a bit. So there's this idea, once they had the concept that that genes are involved in the transcription of RNA, and then RNA, mRNA specifically, is used as a blueprint to produce proteins. There were two views, and they're referred to as collinearity and non-collinearity. And the idea of collinearity is that the size of a gene, the number of nucleotides in a gene on the DNA, should correspond with the number of amino acids in a protein. Okay? And so they did experiments, but this is one of the differences between eukaryotes and prokaryotes. In prokaryotes, what they found is there's a direct relation between the size of a gene and the number of amino acids in a protein that the gene encodes. They're directly related. For every three nucleotides, there was an amino acid in the protein. Okay. So prokaryotic genes are directly collinear. But what they found is in eukaryotic genes, there was this general trend towards larger genes encoding larger proteins, but there wasn't a direct ratio that was true all the time. And in fact, the more that they sampled, the larger the range of variation that they found. And the technique that they used is, it's referred to as RNA-DNA hybridization. You can get RNA and DNA to anneal to each other via complementary base pairs. Okay, but remember, RNA is a less durable molecule, so the limiting step to these types of experiments is how long the RNA will persist. So what they did was they took DNA that encoded an RNA molecule, and they took the RNA and mixed the DNA and the RNA together. They heated them up, so they were single-stranded. Then you let them cool down. And the DNA can re-anneal to itself, and it frequently does that. But in some cases, the RNA that was produced off of the DNA during transcription can anneal to that region of the DNA. And what they found was, in many cases, when RNA annealed to, when messenger RNA annealed to the DNA that it was transcribed from, there was more DNA sequences represented than there were RNA sequences. So this loop indicates DNA structures that are not included in the sequence of RNA. So when we've been talking about transcription, we've been talking about RNA polymerase walking down, grabbing a nucleotide for every base on the DNA, and finding its complement. But when they isolated the final form of RNA in the cells, there were gaps. There were parts of the DNA, sequences from the DNA, that were not represented in the RNA. And that was true in eukaryotes. It's not true in prokaryotes for the vast, vast majority of cases. So that led to the idea that there has to be some processing or manipulation of RNA in eukaryotes. Okay. So we're going to talk about gene structure specifically in eukaryotes. Okay. The gene structure, so these are things that we'll get to. For prokaryotes, we've already talked about the gene structure. You know everything in a prokaryote. You need a promoter. Right? Then you've got the encoding sequence. Right? This is where initiation happens. The RNA transcription unit is where elongation takes place. And then you've got a terminator. That's it in prokaryotes. Really simple. The polymerase binds. It makes an exact complement to the template strand, except an RNA, and then it leaves, and you get an RNA molecule that looks just like this DNA. Okay? With eukaryotes, it's more complicated. And specifically, we'll talk about a few important areas called introns and exons. So those bits of DNA that were not represented in the RNA sequence are referred to as introns. Okay? And I'll apologize now for nomenclature again. We've got introns and exons. Okay? The parts of the DNA sequences, that are represented are exons. And if you just think about N, oh, it's in there, X, it's out of there, you're backwards. Okay? What these are short for, exons are expressed. Okay, so these are DNA sequences that are reflected in the RNA. Okay? Introns are intervening. So they are not in the RNA sequences at the end. Okay? And then with these, we're talking about mature RNA. After RNA is made, there's time allowed to process it. But don't think in terms of intron, it's in the RNA, exon, it's out of the RNA. Okay, think about expressed or intervening. So there are regions of a eukaryotic gene in which, based on their sequences, they will either be included in the RNA as an exon or excluded from the RNA as an intron. Eukaryotic genes will still have a promoter and they'll still have a terminator, but now scattered throughout this encoding region, now we have introns and exons. So you'd have like exon 1, intron, exon 2, intron, exon 3. Okay, so you'll see maps of eukaryotic genes in which they denote exons and introns. So here we've got a gene. Let's see if we've got a bigger picture. Nope. Okay, so this is the ovalbumin gene. So this is basically the egg white gene, okay, from a chicken. And if you look, the darker shaded areas are exons, and the lighter shaded areas are introns. Okay? So the promoter is up here. This is the encoding region. The terminator is down here. The majority of the structure of this gene are introns. There's a lot more light greenish gray than there is moss green. Okay? So if we were to look at the RNA after it's been produced and it's matured, okay, and we'll talk about the specific mechanisms in a little bit, we would see the sequences that correspond to these exons, one right after the other. So here's exon 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8's the big one at the end. And then we've got a little bit going on upstream, a little bit going on downstream. Okay? But in comparative size, you've got a relatively large gene that's making a fairly discrete or small RNA molecule. Here's a cytochrome B gene. Cytochrome B is used in electron transport chain in energetics. Same type of situation. The introns are actually larger on average than are the exons, so you get a smaller RNA molecule than the gene. Okay. So the mechanism is not facilitated. So intron exclusion is not facilitated during transcription. Okay, RNA polymerase is not smart enough to do that. When I was walking along here grabbing those nucleotides, I can't go and go, oh, I'm at the edge of an exon and an intron. I'm just not going to grab bases for a while. I'm going to walk down here until I see here's our next exon. That's not the way it happens. In terms of mechanisms and in terms of ease on an exam, it would be nice if that's the way it happens. But it's not RNA polymerase just differentially transcribing exons and avoiding introns. This entire DNA sequence is transcribed as an RNA molecule of the same size. And then what happens? The introns are spliced out, removed, and the exons are attached together. Okay? And we'll talk a little bit about that mechanism. And I think in general, you guys just made it through 8th week stuff. You probably would benefit from a little bit shorter lecture maybe today, so I may not hammer you guys over the head with as many details today. Get you out of here so you can recharge a little bit. All right, so when we talk about genes, we're talking about the DNA sequence. I mentioned this a couple times. I've got a colleague. He's a philosopher. He could go on for hours about what the definition of a gene is. If you're talking to a molecular biologist like me, a gene is a fragment of DNA that encodes an RNA molecule. And so for it to encode an RNA molecule, you need a promoter, you need an encoding region, and then at the end you've got a terminator. So when we, from this point on, when we're talking about genes, think about this type of structure for a eukaryote. For a prokaryote, it's all exon. It's all expressed. Remember, prokaryotes need to be fast and simple and easy. They don't want to carry around any extra DNA because that slows down their ability to replicate their chromosome. And that's the rate-limiting step in the life of many bacteria. So if you've got a bunch of DNA that's not present in RNA, you're wasting time, you're wasting space, you're wasting energy if you're a bacterium. Remember, eukaryotes like this ability to be very sophisticated in their ability to regulate stuff. The intron and exon system allows them much more control on things. The other big difference is, remember, one of the fundamental differences in the cell types between a prokaryote and a eukaryote, there's no nuclear membrane in prokaryotes. Eukaryotes have a nuclear membrane. Okay. So we'll talk about this next week when we get the translation, but you've got a nuclear membrane. Okay, inside the nucleus, transcription takes place inside the nucleus. Translation takes place outside the nucleus. Okay. So any RNA that's going to be used in translation, you've got time to manipulate it before it ever sees a functional ribosome. If we've got a bacterial cell, there's no nuclear membrane, you've got the chromosome, transcription and translation take place at the same time. And in fact, what we'll see is some pictures in which RNA polymerase is producing an RNA molecule, and it's already bound by ribosomes making proteins. There is no time to manipulate RNA in a bacterium. As soon as, even before the RNA molecule is being finished, there are ribosomes that are making the protein that molecule will encode if it's an mRNA molecule. So you don't have time to splice out introns if you're a bacterium. You do because this nuclear membrane buys you time. You've got a safe environment in which you can manipulate RNA before it's ever going to be translated. If you didn't have the nuclear membrane, or if you had functional ribosomes in the nucleus and you still wanted to modify your RNA, you would make a lot of wrong proteins. Okay? You need to finish the modification of your RNA before it's translated. Otherwise, you've wasted all that time making a wrong protein. Yep.
Do you want to know anything about introns having to do with evolution?
Not at this point. When we get to evolution, we'll come back and revisit them. Okay, so we're going to talk about, the other day we put up that list of like 20 different types of RNA, and then there are really 5 that we're going to focus on in here, the 3 that are involved in protein synthesis, so messenger RNA, ribosomal RNA, and transfer RNA, and then a couple of inhibitory RNA molecules that we'll talk about later. And in eukaryotes, we'll talk about the way in which they're modified. That process is referred to as maturation. And at the end of RNA processing, you've got a mature RNA molecule is the terminology. So if you hear me refer to mature RNA, it means all the processing that was supposed to be done on it has been done on it. So we'll start out with mRNA because the largest number of individual genes in the cell encode mRNA molecules. The total amount of RNA inside of a cell, ribosomal RNA is the most common RNA because ribosomes are made of it, but the largest number of genes encode mRNA. Okay, so with mRNA, you've got a gene that looks like this. Okay, we've got the promoter region up here. Okay, and then we start producing the RNA. Okay, and so we're not showing exons and introns here. We're just showing the gross structure of the RNA. You have a 5' untranslated region. Okay, so the name's telling you a lot. Okay, it's near the 5' end of the molecule and untranslated. It means that these sequences will not be reflected in any protein sequence. Okay, and then there's a Shine-Dalgarno sequence. That's basically a promoter for translation, and we'll talk about that on Tuesday. Then you've got the protein coding or encoding region. That's the part of the gene that specifically determines what amino acid is at what position in the protein that will result from translation. Okay? So this is the part of the molecule that conveys that biological information to express a particular protein. Then you've got a stop codon that stops translation. And again, we'll talk about that mechanism on Tuesday. And then you've got a 3' untranslated region. So, same thing. It's at the 3' end of this RNA molecule, and it's not translated. Okay. So, the gene structure corresponds with this RNA structure. All right. We'll skip that for now. But just remember, this is also sometimes referred to as the upstream. Untranslated, this is the downstream. Remember, we're moving from 5 to 3 with RNA molecules. Okay, so an mRNA molecule is produced, and it's just this unprocessed molecule. And it's in the nucleus. This is in eukaryotes. Okay, this is the stuff that's not happening in prokaryotes. It is happening in eukaryotes. So there are 3 main modifications that I want you to know about in eukaryotic mRNA processing. Okay, the first is, it's referred to as capping, or the addition of a 5' cap. Okay. And the cap is typically a methylguanine cap that's attached to the 5' end. At this point, all I want you to know is a 5' cap. Okay? So we've got here's our mRNA molecule. Here's the 5'. There's the 3'. And we add our cap, 5' cap. Okay? That does a few things. It increases the stability of the molecule. It helps identify it as an mRNA molecule inside of the cell. Okay? The other thing that happens, or the second thing that happens, is there's an addition of a poly A tail at the 3' end. And so a large number of ribonucleotides with an adenine base are added to the end. Okay? I want you to be aware that the poly A tail is not represented by sequences within the gene. Okay? You don't see a lot of T's on the template strand to produce A's. These are added enzymatically after transcription in the nucleus. Okay? So this is referred to as the poly A tail. And this is a hallmark of messenger RNA. If you're a scientist and you want to just pull down the RNA or the messenger RNA, you come up with a bunch of beads that have poly T stuck to them, and they will specifically grab this poly A from the messenger RNA. So if you ever use a kit in a biotech lab or the genetics lab that pulls down messenger RNA, it does so by the presence of this poly A tail. Oh, yeah. after transcription. Okay, so it's not RNA polymerase that's adding a bunch of A's at the end. The RNA molecule is produced first, and then enzymatically the poly A tail is added inside the nucleus. And the length of the poly A tail is variable. So it can be typically between 50 and 250 nucleotides. So it's quite a few. All right, then the third step, So we've modified both ends of the molecule now. We've modified the 5' end with the cap, the 3' end with the poly A tail, and the third step is RNA splicing. Okay. And RNA splicing is just a term that we use for the removal of introns. Okay. And then at the same time that we're removing the introns, we need to connect those exon sequences together. And when you get to molecular biology with Dr. Larson, you will spend a lot of time talking about this. Actually, I had lunch with Eric Larson the other day, and he said he's got some students in molecular biology that are struggling with the complementary base thing, too. So if you missed the complementary base pairing on the test, you will see that question again until you demonstrate to me that you understand complementary base pairing before I let you move on. Those of you that got it right, good job. You're ready to move forward with your life as a geneticist. Those of you that didn't, I'm going to hammer away at you until you scream out GC in your sleep. Hopefully an ex-acquaintance of yours is not named GC, because that could be awkward. So, all right. So here's what's going on with splicing, that there's a structure referred to as a lariat structure. And the RNA wraps back on itself and forms this structure that looks a lot like a lariat. If you're not ancient like me, and let's see, you guys rarely get to see Westerns anymore, a lasso or a rope that a cowboy throws. If you don't know either of those terms, if that's not doing it for you, I got nothing. So it loops back on itself at the 5' end, and then there's a specialized, very complicated structure called a spliceosome. Okay. And the spliceosome has RNA in it. It's got a huge number of small proteins that are in it, and its job is to carry out this reaction. A small number of genes have the ability to self-splice. So they're not common in nature. An example would be mitochondrial genes inside of fungi, that their RNA is autocatalytic and it can just pop out introns. Remember at the very beginning of the semester I mentioned that our view of abiogenesis is converting to one in which we are pretty confident that catalytic RNA molecules were the first self-replicating molecules. So an RNA molecule that has the ability to carry out its own splicing is consistent with that model. Okay, so this structure comes along, and you get this basically a three-way stop that's happening with the 5' end and an intervening sequence. And then there's basically just a substitution reaction that takes place where a covalent bond is formed with this end and at this branch point. Okay? And that results in the loss of the intron. Okay? But it happens a little bit down from this lariat point. It doesn't happen right there. That the lariat is basically a spacing mechanism. Okay, so the lariat will form, it will branch back on itself, usually about 50 nucleotides, 20 to 50 nucleotides upstream of the branch point. Okay? Mechanistically, I don't expect you guys to remember a lot of this. OK? Okay? I just want you to be aware of the fact that there is a lariat structure that is an important intermediate step in splicing. Okay? And that the large structure that carries it out is called the spliceosome. Okay? But you just can't pop out the introns because the exons then aren't covalently linked. So you need to reform those phosphodiester linkages to bring the exons together into one continuous molecule. Okay. All right. Now, there are sequences that denote the branch points between introns and exons. Okay. And I'm not expecting you to memorize those, but they are conserved sequences that denote the end of an intron, or the beginning of an exon, the end of an exon. So a eukaryotic geneticist can look at a DNA sequence. They can either do it by eye if they're an old geneticist, or new ones never learned to do that, so they just enter it in the computer, save yourself a bunch of time, and predict splice sites. And so you could enter a DNA sequence from a eukaryote, and you can have the prediction of what the mature mRNA will look like. It will identify the introns, remove those sequences, and then bring the exon sequences together. Okay? And that's the way many genes work, that there are very definitive introns, very definitive exons. They were always spliced that same way. Okay? However, there are some genes in which there's alternative splicing that takes place. And by alternative splicing, it could take a few different forms. It can mean in one version, a particular sequence is an intron. Okay, so here we've got exon 1, exon 2, exon 3, intron 1 and 2. Okay, and this would be the way that it would be spliced, and you would just have exon 1, 2, and 3 together. If this is alternatively spliced, this intron in an alternative splicing may be exon 2B. And this whole region may be present. Okay? Another way of splicing is to not include all of the same exons. Okay, so alternative splicing is a way in which you can have one DNA gene and you could produce different proteins. And that discovery was huge because up until that point, the mantra in molecular biology and molecular genetics was one gene, one protein. If you had one sequence on DNA molecule that produced one protein, that would always be the same as long as the DNA sequence was always the same. And then with alternative splicing, they found, no, you can have one gene, you can have several different proteins. And then they started finding ones that had more and more alternative splice forms. And I think right now the leader is, it's a protein called ankyrin. It's involved in cell-cell adherence. So you've got in eukaryote cells together, and you want to make sure that they stay together. And so they make these membrane-bound proteins called ankyrins that are really big, and they help different cell types stick together. And ankyrin's involved, or it's pretty heavily involved in cancer research, because one of the differences between a benign tumor and a malignant tumor is benign tumors replicate on site. You get a tumor that forms, but it's not going anywhere. With a malignant tumor, they lose that cell-cell contact with each other and the cells start migrating through your body to form new tumors. So the loss of cell-cell adherence is really important in cancer research, and ankyrin is a big part of it. And I think as of last year, they've identified over 62,000 splice variants from the single ankyrin gene. So you've got 62,000 RNA molecules that can result in 62,000 different proteins from a single gene. I've been telling you about how prokaryotes are the efficient ones. If you do splicing variants, you can produce a large number of proteins from one discrete fragment of DNA. So the mechanisms, you don't need to know, just the idea that you have the same DNA sequence, and under different conditions, exons and introns will be recognized differently. And you can produce different proteins as a result of alternative splicing. The phrase itself, you ought to be comfortable with that. It gives you multiple mRNA molecules and multiple proteins from a single gene. Okay. So those are the three steps in processing or modification of mRNA. The addition of the 5' cap, the addition of the 3' poly A tail, and RNA splicing, which involves the removal of introns and the connection of those exons together. At that point, you have a mature mRNA molecule, and it's ready to be translated. Okay? Until these three steps are done, that molecule is not ready to be translated. And all three of these steps take place in the nucleus. Okay? You can bet that you will see a question about these three steps a few weeks down the road, so make sure that you get on those. Okay? All right. Then on top of this, modification or processing of mRNA, there's another general area of manipulating RNA called RNA editing. And for a long time, molecular biologists had this view that once you make an RNA molecule, it's out there, you know, and once it's processed and it's mature, it's out there, and as long as that molecule persists, that it'll be used in translation. And there's really no post-transcriptional, post-processing way that you can affect transcription or RNA levels. Okay, but then they identified RNA editing, and RNA editing sort of screwed with everybody's head for a while because we've had this idea that the sequence of an RNA molecule will be directly determined by the sequence of the gene from which it was transcribed. Okay? And that's not always the case. That there were a lot of grad students that were beaten over the head by their bosses in the lab because they were coming up with RNA molecules that had sequences that did not correspond with the DNA sequences. And at that time, the RNA should always correspond 100% with the DNA from which it was transcribed. So if you've got this widely held belief among all of your scientific peers and you've got a second-year grad student in the lab, you beat the second-year grad student instead of change the paradigm. And after a sufficient number of grad students were beaten, they thought, well, wait, maybe they're not that bad after all. Maybe there's actually something going on. And that something going on is called RNA editing, in which the sequence of RNA molecules can be changed after transcription. Not just the structure. We're not cutting bits out. We're not just sticking things on the end. The actual sequence and the encoding regions can be manipulated and can be changed. And so the RNA can come in here that you get a molecule called guide RNA. And guide RNA is essential for RNA editing. Here we've got mRNA sequence. This is before it's been edited. The guide RNA has some complementary nature to it. So much of the sequence is complementary, but it's got these gaps. So there are more sequences on the guide RNA than there are the pre-edited RNA. And so then the guide RNA basically serves as a template in which these extra sequences are added so that then the edited RNA is the same length and the same or complementary sequence to the guide RNA. Okay? So it's, as of now, it's always a situation in which post-editing, there are more sequences present in the RNA molecule than pre-editing. We're adding nucleotides during editing. Okay? But all of this happens after transcription. So you get an RNA molecule that's larger than you would predict based on the DNA, and it's got nucleotides that aren't present in the DNA sequence. Now that we know to look for it, that there are labs that basically look at RNA editing, the frequency at which it happens, we now think is greater than originally thought. Thought it was just this aberrant thing that happened on very rare occasions, and now there are labs that are suggesting that it's something that happens in most tissue types and higher organisms. Okay. So this is just a summary of what we've been talking about with the three steps. You've got this eukaryotic gene. Here's the untranslated. Here we've got exon 1, exon 2, exon 3. And we've got capping, tailing, and then splicing. And then it could be edited to add a few nucleotides in there. Let's get out of here sooner. Okay, so that's mRNA. So remember that RNA editing takes place with mRNA, but it doesn't always happen. These three things always happen with eukaryotic mRNA. Okay. So now we're going to talk about transfer RNA. And we'll talk about on Tuesday, it's the job of transfer RNA to bring amino acids to the ribosome when translation is taking place. So tRNA is basically a delivery mechanism. Okay? But tRNA, you'll see them drawn as sort of this upside down clover leaf in diagrams. But remember, you're looking at a two-dimensional structure. RNA likes to bend and twist around so that it makes complementary base pairing. So actually, tRNA looks like this upside-down L structure that's twisted around in three dimensions. But usually in your book, you'll see it as a cloverleaf. So there's some modifications that take place in tRNA molecules. They're transcribed. They're not very big. This is the entire tRNA molecule. But what happens post transcriptionally is you get base modifications. There are rare bases in tRNA molecules. So we've talked about the four bases that you see in RNA. So you get adenine, uracil, guanine, cytosine in RNA. But in tRNA molecules, shown at these red dots, that there are substituted bases that aren't one of those four. Okay? That doesn't happen during transcription. When it's transcribed, the four, you know, common or garden variety bases are put in there, and afterwards these bases are substituted enzymatically. Okay, so again, RNA polymerase doesn't have a lot of fun tricks up its sleeve. It doesn't do anything special. Anything really unique that's happening with these RNA molecules are happening after transcription. So these rare bases are modified and they're substituted in there. And then there's another thing I want you to know is the amino acid attachment site. tRNA will deliver an amino acid to the ribosome. That amino acid will always be attached to the 3' end of the tRNA. And so the 3' end is referred to as the attachment site. Okay. But rare bases, they're modified after transcription. Okay, then the last one that we'll talk about out of the big three is ribosomal RNA. And some of the component parts of ribosomal RNA is processed after transcription as well. With ribosomal RNA, there's two subunits, the large and small subunits, and there's RNA in each, a distinct RNA molecule in each, and a large number of small proteins, much like the spliceosome. So if we look, one of the differences between bacteria and your cells is ribosomal structure. And in fact, quite a few of the antibiotics that are available if you get a bacterial disease are aimed at attacking bacterial ribosomes, and they typically won't attack your ribosomes. With antibiotics, it's one of the things that you have to... Antibiotic's not a great term. Antibiotic just means against life. Cyanide is a wonderful antibiotic. It's just not highly selective. Okay? So when they look for selective therapeutic antibiotics, they look for a difference between the infecting agent and the host. Okay? So with bacteria, there are some fundamental differences between bacteria and yeast, so that gives the pharmacologist a big window to shoot for. Okay, with viruses, viruses oftentimes don't bring in a lot of their own stuff. They just manipulate your own cell machinery. Remember, it's a tank that takes over the Mitsubishi motor plant, and it uses the stuff that's already at Mitsubishi. So it's much tougher to come up with an antiviral agent since it's using your own cellular machinery. Fungi are even tougher because fungi are eukaryotes, and so much of their cell machinery looks just like yours. So if you go to Costa Rica over Thanksgiving and you come up or come back with a fungal infection, it's going to take 8 weeks of treatment to clear that infection, because that window of the difference between the fungus and you basically comes down to mycolic acid, you know, the structure, the outer structure of a fungus is different than your cell structure, and it takes a while to treat that. So there's a relatively big difference between bacterial ribosomes and eukaryotic ribosomes, but both are comprised of a large and small subunit. We'll talk about those much more on Tuesday. The main modification that I want you to be aware of for ribosomal sequences is methylation. Okay. So let's see. Let's erase this guy. Okay. I'll just write a reminder for tRNA. We get rare bases that are incorporated, and that's a modification. Okay, for ribosomal RNA, two things, methylation. Okay. And so that's just the technical term for the addition of a methyl group. Methylation of nucleic acids is fairly common modification. It dramatically changes a lot of the physical properties of the nucleic acid in that local area. And so the addition of a methyl group is something that we'll see throughout molecular genetics. And so we get bases that get methylated, and they're methylated at carbon 2. In the pentose. Okay, remember we've got, here's the base coming off of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Carbon 2 is the one that, there's a hydroxyl in RNA that's not there in DNA, and it's carbon 2 that gets methylated. Okay, the other thing that takes place in most of the organisms is the ribosomal RNA genes will be transcribed as one large unit, and then they get cleaved. And technically, this isn't splicing because we're not annealing parts together. We're not removing bits and then reconnecting the ends. We're just cutting out unneeded sequences to produce, in the case of prokaryotes, a 16S, 23S. Those are the main ribosomal RNA molecules. In the case of eukaryotes, an 18S, a 28S, and a 5.8S molecule. So they're transcribed in one big unit, methylated, and then they're cut up into the individual smaller units. Okay? So it would be lovely in my world if you guys learned the modifications of mRNA, tRNA, and ribosomal RNA. Okay. And that's where molecular genetics stood for a long time, that those were the three types of RNA molecules that you needed to know. With them, you could make proteins. We could carry out regulation at the transcriptional level or at the translation. We had a lot of flexibility with how we did things. And then there was this problem with eukaryotes have so many things that look like little tiny genes that don't encode a protein. What's going on with that? And you know, for a long time it was referred to as junk DNA. So we're talking about unique sequences. They're not part of those repetitive sequences that are present on the chromosome. They look like genes. They've got promoter regions, but there's just no protein, and they're not big enough to encode a functional protein. And several years ago, then, scientists started finding a use for these things, both biologically and in research labs, and it's referred to as RNA interference. Okay? And it's the idea that if you think about a cell and, you know, the central dogma of molecular biology and of genetics is this thing that we've been beating into the ground, that's information on DNA is used to synthesize RNA through transcription. Okay, and that's used in the process of translation to make proteins. And proteins are the workhorse of a cell. The proteins have a wide range of functions within the cell. If you need something done in a cell, you want a protein to do that job. If you want a protein to do that job, you better have a gene to encode that protein. So, and cells, you know, need to be efficient. If you're an inefficient cell, you're not in business very long. And so there's this problem that popped up in theory. Even though RNA molecules aren't very durable and they fall apart or get chewed up very easily, they still have a respectable half-life. An RNA molecule that's produced can persist for, you know, hours to, in some cases, days. If you're a cell and you need to make a protein to do something right now, okay, and you transcribe that RNA, it's translated into the protein and it carries out that function, you can inhibit, if you remember back in 197 or your comparable class, you can inhibit these proteins with either a competitive or non-competitive inhibitor. So you can stop the activity of the protein, but if that messenger RNA molecule is still floating around, you're wasting energy producing those proteins that you don't need. And that just always seemed inefficient, that even though you've got this short half-life of a molecule, in some cases that could be way too long. And so the idea of RNA interference is these small RNA sequences anneal to mRNA that encode these proteins, and they facilitate a more rapid degradation. So when these proteins are no longer needed, you just don't wait for the RNA to break down. You actually produce small RNA molecules that speeds up the breakdown of unneeded mRNA molecules. Okay? And there are two main classes of interfering RNAs that we'll talk about in here. The first are microRNAs. Okay, and the other is referred to as siRNA, small interfering RNA. And they have a lot in common. Mechanistically, there's one big difference between them. But here's what happens. So with microRNA, in the gene that encodes the microRNA, so this is showing the DNA up here, in the microRNA, there are inverted repeats. Whenever you see inverted repeats in DNA, if you produce an RNA molecule, it means that it will form a stem loop structure. Okay? So what happens is you transcribe this relatively small piece of RNA, and it folds up in a stem loop structure. Okay? So you've got this guy that looks like here. Let me see if we've got... Okay. So we've got this stem loop structure. There is a protein that comes in. It's actually a complex molecule called dicer. And dicer does just what you would think a molecule called dicer does. It takes that double-stranded RNA molecule from the microRNA, that stem loop structure, and it cuts it up into smaller RNA molecules. Okay? And the optimal size for this is about 20 or 18 to 22 nucleotides, so bases. Okay? with small interfering RNA, well, let's just go ahead and look at what happens then. We'll stay with our microRNAs. Okay. Then there's specific proteins that will bind to small RNA. They recognize, okay, this is double-stranded. They recognize double-stranded RNA of 18 to 22 base pairs, sorry. But they can only bind to one strand. And so they've got a pocket where they can bind to about an 18 to 22 nucleotide single-stranded RNA. And that process, or that once it does, becomes called RISC. Okay, so it's the RNA interference complex. Right? So Dicer cuts it up, RISC comes and binds, and RISC carries that RNA molecule around with it. Okay? And RISC then will go along, once it's bound to one of these small pieces of RNA, it will look for mRNA and will bind to it and find somewhat complementary sequences. They don't have to be perfect. Okay? It's one of the differences between microRNAs and this small inhibiting. MicroRNA doesn't have to find its perfect complement. And when RISC binds to something that looks enough like the RNA molecule that it's carrying around, then it inhibits translation. Okay? So you've got this big RISC molecule stuck here on the mRNA, and translation takes place, so you're not going to produce any more protein off of this mRNA molecule. Okay? That's the way that the story stood when they published your textbook. They now also know that microRNAs, when RISC binds, it can result in the degradation of this mRNA molecule too. So the RNA molecule gets chewed up in a small number of cases. Most of the times with microRNAs, though, you're just preventing this protein from being produced. Okay, you're blocking translation. Okay, with small interfering RNAs, what happens is you express a double-stranded large RNA molecule. Okay, so you produce a complement. If you want to knock out an mRNA molecule, you basically have a gene that encodes the complementary sequence. And then that RNA will anneal to the mRNA. In some cases, you have two different genes that encode complementary things, but one of them is complementary to the mRNA. Okay? So one of these strands is a complement to the mRNA. But you make a double-stranded RNA. With microRNAs, you're making a stem loop, and the stem part is double-stranded, but it's not two separate RNA molecules. It's just one that's folding up on itself. And then very similar thing happens. Dicer comes in again, cuts it into 18 to 22 nucleotide double-stranded fragments. Then the RISC protein without RNA comes in, binds it, and you get the RISC complex that's formed with the RNA, with one strand of RNA. And then RISC, if it forms a perfect match with the base pair, that will result in degradation. So the RNA molecule is actually chewed up with small interfering RNAs. So big picture, if you put out more RNA than you need, or if the RNA is going to last past the window of time in which you want to express those proteins, you can do a take-back inside the cell. And the way that you do a take-back is expressing these complementary RNA sequences that, once they're associated with RISC, will bind to the mRNA and either keep it from being translated or result in it being broken down. But in both cases, you need to know what Dicer does. You need to know what RISC does, okay, in both of those cases. And out of that list of, you know, like 20 different types of RNA that we talked about a couple weeks ago, what scientists are finding more and more that there are different mechanisms for RNA interference. And so they're starting to appreciate that there's a lot of different mechanisms by which you can silence message that's already been transcribed. Okay? Now, in terms of the lab, RNA silencing is a really useful tool. There's a model organism that scientists work on, some geneticists work on it, some neurobiologists work on it. It's called C. elegans, Caenorhabditis elegans. It's this transparent little worm. And so since it's transparent, it's really easy to work with. You can inject certain cells with a green dye, watch where they go to during development. But it's much easier to go in and make mutations in a bacterium and then look at what you broke. But with organisms like C. elegans, and now they're doing it in Drosophila, and actually you can do something very similar in zebrafish, you can inject interfering RNA into the cells of these organisms and essentially shut off translation of a gene. And you're not altering the sequence of a gene, so you're strictly not making a mutation, but you're mimicking a mutation by preventing a gene from being expressed with interfering RNA. So it's a naturally occurring process, but if you go and do research in David Rubin's lab or Kevin Edwards' lab in the department, you're probably going to work with interfering RNAs to, in essence, knock out gene expression and then look to see what happens in your organism. And then here's just a picture of C. elegans. From time to time in your book, that there's just something similar to a baseball card of model organisms used in genetics. We've been ignoring them so far. We had E. coli and Saccharomyces cerevisiae yeast, brewer's yeast, that we skipped over. But that C. elegans and interfering RNA is a useful tool in there. One of the things they can do with C. elegans is when it develops, they know the ultimate fate of each cell at every point during development. And so they've got this flow chart. You start out with the zygote, and then this cell goes this direction, that cell. For each cell division, they know where that cell will ultimately wind up. And so in terms of using it as a developmental, as an organism to study developmental biology and how cells change shape and how they migrate to the right spot, I mean, think about it. You started out as a single cell, a little sphere, and when you were born, then you came out looking largely human, you know, except you've got that massive baby head, and which is really unfortunate for mom. And I mean, something's not right there, that you'd think after enough evolution that we would have really conical-shaped heads and be even more slippery than we are. Humans will be born with, like, bicyclist helmet things when they do the time trials at some point. And some babies do. Your head's flexible, and so it kind of gets conical. One of my two kids was a cone head when they were born. But there's a lot of cell expansion, cell migration that takes place to get you from a sphere to something that looks human. And we don't understand the vast majority of it. And so by understanding how all these cells move and differentiate in a little worm, we're starting to understand how you take place in utero. And one of the most powerful tools that has been developed is interfering RNA to knock out that gene and see, does that cell go to the right spot? Does it expand to make the right shapes? And then you can identify genes in C. elegans. You are freakishly similar at the DNA level with C. elegans and many of your developmental genes that they've discovered so far. So on that really flattering note, I send you large bipedal worms out into the world. All right, enjoy your extra time. Use it for good, not evil.